Folk music, what it is, where it came from, and why it matters. The American Folk Festival gets underway in a week, which will draw as many as 100,000 people over 3 days. They'll see 15 featured folk performers on 4 stages, representing a range of genres, from Texas blues to gospel to Zimbabwe vocal harmony. It's a showcase of the idea that the folk music tradition expands well beyond the realm of Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bob Dylan, or Woody Guthrie. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll learn much more about what truly defines folk music, about its origins, and about how it's changed over centuries. We'll explore how folk music fits into the larger study of folklore, and why it's an important reflection of who we are. We'll also talk about where folk music is today, and learn more about the major national festival that's about to return to Maine for its 17th year. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. For many of us, folk music equals Peter, Paul, and Mary, the Kingston Trio, or Pete Seeger. But folk music has a rich and diverse heritage that may surprise you. Next weekend, Bangor hosts the American Folk Music Festival. And today, we're going to learn all about this important musical tradition. In the studio with me, Felicia Knight, president of the Knight A Canny Group, a member of the board of Portland Ovations, and a former communications director at the National Endowment for the Arts. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Heather McCarthy. She's executive director of the American Folk Festival. Also joining us from Bangor is Craig Ettinger. He's the University of Maine's Folk Life Center and Maine Studies director. And as always, we want to hear from you. What do you think of when you hear the term folk music? The number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to Maine Calling, all of you. Craig, let's start with you. What is folk music? Is it defined by its origins or by musical forms? What makes a folk song a folk song?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for a long time, folk music was thought of as music of the people and was characterized as music where you couldn't even necessarily determine where the authorship was. It was music that was passed down from generation to generation, often in families and small communities, and based on ballads and other traditional forms that go back many hundreds of years. At some point more recently, probably within the past 40 or 50 years, it kind of changed in meaning. And I think our other two guests would have more to say about the contemporary definitions of folk music. But individual authorship and kind of the role of the singer-songwriter has become more important in characterizing what folk music is. But in all cases, it's representative of a particular culture or a particular community. And so there's a very important cultural aspect to it.
Yeah. Felicia, really, encompasses a whole range of locations, cultures, jobs in some cases. Answer that same question, I guess. What is folk music?
Very much so. And I agree with everything that Craig just said. And I think that when we think of folk music today, it really takes on a global atmosphere and many times cultures within cultures. Yes, it's very much oriented in certain nationalities, and folk music, folk and traditional music can be looked at as a part of that national cultural patrimony. And yes, it's handed down from generation to generation, but it evolves, and it sometimes goes through an amalgamation with other cultures or with other musical forms. At Portland Ovations, we often bring in what you might think on the face of it are traditional artists, yet they are, for instance, last year we had a Ukrainian group. Yes, Ukrainian folk music fused with jazz, with rock. And that is still folk music. It's cultural. It tells a story. It reflects a nationality, a heritage, but it also evolves into something contemporary. And the term folk music today is as wide-ranging as societies.
So Heather, when you're putting together a festival of this type that's going to start next weekend, how you have so many acts to choose from and so many musical forms from which to curate that festival. How do you decide? How do you pick the acts that you want and the experience that you want the audience to have?
Well, it's true that we've pretty much got the world to choose from. And what we do is look at some of those traditions that our audience has come to count on. It being Maine, some of the Franco traditions are very important to our audience. So, you know, we bring groups from Quebec or other French-speaking communities, and they are always very well attended. This year, it'll be Jean de Corum. Then, as Felicia was talking about, some of those folk traditions that are very much rooted in a tradition of 10 or 20 or 50 or 80 years ago that are now being reinvented and reinvigorated and blended with another tradition. So we'll look at some of those performing groups that are taking those older traditions and bringing new life to them, doing something new with them, and really creating some new and exciting art. And we want to really share that with our audience.
And remind us of the history of the festival. This is the 17th year of the American Folk Festival, but it had a predecessor?
The National Folk Festival has been going for decades now, and that is shepherded by a group out of Washington, D.C., the National Council for Traditional Arts. They brought the National Folk Festival to Bangor starting in 2002 with the hope that it would plant a seed for something that continued here in Maine past the 3 years of the National. We've been working very hard to keep that going. The National Folk Festival itself has moved on to several other communities since then, and the seed that was planted here in Bangor has really taken some solid root.
Yeah.
And that's been the goal of the National Folk Festival since it began in 1934, to do exactly what the city of Bangor did, take the National, and it goes in residency for 3 years, wherever it goes. This year it's in Salisbury, Maryland, and it stays for 3 years to take root, to get people used to coming, to get them excited about it, and then hopefully to support it going forward in a city. So the National Council for the Traditional Arts now has this in myriad cities all across the United States.
Craig, folk music, I wonder if we could get into this, the role, I guess, that folk music plays within this discipline of folklore. Tell us about folklore and what it is as an academic study and the role that folk music plays within that.
Right. Well, the definition of folklore is just about as broad maybe as the definition of folk music, in that it encompasses a lot of things, from traditional poems and ballads and things that might fall under the heading of literature to superstitions and folk tales and legends and myths, as well as contemporary stories about how people do things in their particular way of life. So folklore is a very broad category, and I guess folk music is connected to it in that in the past, the same people who would collect ballads that were sung were the same people who would collect poems, and essentially there was a disconnect between often the verses of a ballad, the words of a ballad, and the music, which could change over time as different people adopted it in different areas. There were back in the day when ballads were printed on things called broadsides, which are just basically large single sheets of newspaper. It was just the words, and often the words were set to different tunes in different places. So there's a couple elements of connection there. One, though, is that there's often a story to be told, and the ballads that were sung by minstrels and then later in the 18th and 19th centuries told stories of shipwrecks and murders and kings and so forth. And folk music in its roots also comes from that storytelling tradition. Nowadays, for various reasons, it's a little bit more disconnected from that as it's evolved and morphed, as Felicia has talked about. But there is that strong connection of folklore and folk music to the storytelling tradition.
I have a couple of audio examples, I hope, of what you're talking about in terms of a ballad changing, morphing musically, and incorporating the same words. This is Scarborough Fair.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember
So, and we're all familiar with that, of course. Those of us from a certain age of Simon and Garfunkel. There's another song here performed by folk singer Jenny Gray, a version of a song called The Cambric Shirt, and this is in 1961. Can you give us a little background on her?
Who she was? Say, young man, I am going to the fair for my long life, for my life, lowly. And if you see my true love there, tell me hiddle-o, a diddle-o, for my dumma diddle-o, for my long life, for my life, lowly. Tell her to make me a cambric shirt, for my long life, for my life, lowly. Without a stitch of needlework, tell me hiddle-o, a diddle-o, for my dumma diddle-o, for my long life, for my life, lowly. Tell her to wash it in a dry well, for my long life, for my life, lowly.
Anyway, the clip came in.
Yeah, now two people who listened to those two versions of the song would not even recognize that that's essentially the same song. It derives from a much, much older song that's often called the Elfin Knight, and it goes back to the 1600s, if not earlier, and was collected by collectors like Francis Child in the late 19th century. It tells the story of a lover who's asking somebody to go to a fair and meet his betrothed and kind of test her on a number of different levels and give her some impossible challenges. And then there's an interesting rejoinder from the woman who asked the man to do some impossible challenges, like finding the acre of land between the salt sea and the sea strand, where you can't find an acre of land between the sea and the beach. But it goes on and on like that. And Simon and Garfunkel stylized it, and they only included about three verses, which makes it very confusing to anyone listening to it. But it comes from the same lineage. That song derives from a ballad that's 300 to 400 years old, possibly older. Other people have drawn upon it too, like Bob Dylan in Girl from the North Country. I think it could be termed perhaps the first example of folk sampling when Dylan chooses three lines from the first verse to include in Girl from the North Country. I don't know if you have that one queued up possibly.
I don't.
But there's a lot of borrowing and evolving and stealing basically songs, because that's what folk music is all about. It's about what you can take from previous generations and then mold that to the sensitivities and the sensibilities and the styles and taste of a current audience. Simon and Garfunkel's version, very stylized, very polished and smooth, a beautiful, my introduction to folk music. It was one of the few folk albums that my parents had. And you can detect the lineage in the same way that you might see two biological species who kind of look alike, and you know that they had a similar ancestor. But other than that, it's hard to tell that they're related.
Yeah. Heather, what was it? What was happening in the 60s that spurred this revival of this folk tradition? Was it politics of the time, or what's your sense?
Wow.
or Felicia, you can feel that if you'd rather. Felicia has her hand up. So.
Well, I don't know at all. I'm just going to suggest, if you go back to the Newport Folk Festival, which had its debut, I think, in the late 50s, and George Wein, who most people know of as the creator of the Newport Jazz Festival, kind of had his finger on the pulse of things, and he thought of having a few folk artists come into the jazz festival and realized it was gaining a bigger audience, and created a separate festival for it. And just looking at the evolution of the Newport Folk Festival, you can see the increase in political influence in the songs. And the singer-songwriters like Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger and Joan Baez, who had something socially that they needed and wanted to say, did it through their music. And folk music of the early 60s then began to take on a greater political sense. And then along came the civil rights movement shortly thereafter, and it grew even more into the political realm. And then you have that morphing of the folk music with Bob Dylan especially into rock. And rock is its own kind of folk music. Tells a lot of stories, has a lot of political overtones to it. And so I'm just going through what I know about in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I could actually listen to Craig talk all day about the historic aspects of folk music, but that's just kind of what I remember.
Yeah. Craig,
I'll just add a little bit to it, Keith. So in the 50s, as Felicia was saying, and the Newport Folk Festival started in 1959. She's absolutely right. That was a time when some of the early folk singers like Pete Seeger were really getting their starts. He started first a group called the Almanac Singers in the 1940s, and then in the 50s, a group called the Weavers, which eventually disbanded when Seeger was blacklisted for his supposed communist leanings. But around that time, there had been a lot of collecting of folk songs throughout the early 20th century by various people. We have some great books that are in our library at the Folklife Center. But in 1952, Folkways Record released a multi-disc compilation called Anthology of American Folk Music by Harry Smith, as famous for the liner notes as for the music that it contained. But a lot of budding folk singers listened to that, including my predecessor and the founder of the Maine Folklife Center, Sandy Ives, who was a folk singer himself. And they were inspired by that. And it was the so-called folk revival. A lot of people date to around 1958 or so, when Tom Dooley was released, the Kingston Trio. And they're going to be performing, I know, at the Collins Center in September. And then in the early 60s, when Dylan, Joan Baez came on the scene right around the same time, 1961, 62. So that was the start of the so-called folk revival, capitalized, or the great folk scare, as my brother calls it.
So, and I remember, you know, I was born in 1960, but I remember having Kingston Trio albums in the Magnavox player, but I really didn't understand why it had suddenly become popular. We'll revisit that, and we also will we're going to revisit also some of the work that Sandy has done and had done, and also this other important part, which were these the researchers and archivers and recorders, John and Alan Lomax. We'll have some sound of that in a bit, not quite now, but I wanted you, if you could tell us who they were, Craig, and why they were important.
John Lomax was a collector of songs, was a folklorist himself, and I don't have a detailed biography of him, but he began collecting songs in the early 20th century using the recording equipment that was available at the time, including wax cylinders and aluminum discs and so forth, and going around the South, and he brought his son Alan into it as well, and Alan sort of took over that role through the 30s and 40s, and they recorded many of the people who now are really associated with not only folk music of Appalachia and so forth, but blues, Delta blues. One of their big introductions to the world, I guess you could say, was Huddy Ledbetter, who people know better as Lead Belly, and they recorded him in jail. I can't remember if it was in Texas or Louisiana, but they were among the most prolific of the song collectors, which was a kind of a budding group back in the early 20th century, and they recorded thousands and thousands of songs, including by people here in Maine, a woman named Carrie Grover, who was a well-known today in small folk circles, but was highly influential at the time as a local folk singer, and they recorded her as well. So they played an instrumental role in collecting the materials that eventually became part of the Library of Congress's collection of folk recordings. So they were among a number of different recorders, but they were certainly the most prolific and probably the most influential.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear that clip of Goodnight Irene. And we, of course, urge you to call us and share your thoughts, opinions, stories. 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Cancer Specialists, committed to leading the way to better outcomes for 50 years. More at newenglandcancerspecialists.org. And Bay Chamber Concerts, presenting its summer concert series and Screen Door Festival in Rockport, Maine, July 12th through August 19th. baychamberconcerts.org.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele. This weekend, Live From Here, we'll be coming to you from the Town Hall in New York City with David Crosby.
If I had ever been here before, I would probably know just what to do.
Don't you?
If I had ever been here before, another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to deal with all of you.
plus Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks, and comedian Janine Garofalo. All this and more right here this weekend.
Join us Saturday evening at 6 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Seth Meyers of Late Night on his role in the rise of Donald Trump.
I wanted, like, I helped trick an unelectable person to run for president.
Except for one thing.
And then he won. And when he won, my first thought was, this is Obama's fault.
Seth Meyers, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock and Sunday night at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
As promised, there is Lead Belly with Good Night, Irene. I'm Keith Shortall. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about folk music. And in the studio with me, Felicia Knight. She's a member of the Board of Portland Ovations and a former communications director at the National Endowment for the Arts. From our Bangor studio, American Folk Festival Executive Director Heather McCarthy and UMaine's Folk Life Center Director Craig Ettinger. We invite you to join the conversation. As always, the number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Felicia, during the break, you were making a comment about the importance of the Lomax work.
Yes, and I got to know much more about them when I was at the National Endowment for the Arts. And if they hadn't done what they did, there is so much that would have been lost to our general knowledge regarding the history of American traditional arts and traditional music and the art of storytelling, which in fact came from other countries into the United States. But if the Lomaxes hadn't done that, if they hadn't recorded this, it would be such a loss.
Do you think it was pivotal for the subsequent revivals that happened?
I don't know, but I don't see how it couldn't have had some effect because if you the simple recording by Simon and Garfunkel of Scarborough Fair. They had to have cared about cultural roots of music and found something that spoke to them, and they carried it forward and made it their own.
Yeah. Craig, I wonder if you could talk about the work in the same vein that the Maine Folklife Center has done in documenting traditional ballads and the work that Sandy Ives did there as well.
Yeah, Sandy was to Maine, I guess, what the Lomaxes were to parts of the United States. He came to Maine in the late 1950s from the University of Indiana and was, in addition to being a folklorist, he was a folk singer and balladeer himself, as were many probably of his generation. He began to be interested in kind of collecting his own songs rather than probably singing the ones that he was actually hearing on Folkways records and the things that the Lomaxes and others had collected. So he went out into Maine and then beyond into the Maritimes and Prince Edward Island and found people who were either still singing these songs or remembered them being sung in logging camps and other places and recorded them. Interesting thing was that at the time, like many folk song collectors, other than the Lomaxes and those who were interested in recording full songs, he was interested in the lyrics, the ballads, and he would collect songs on tape. He would transcribe them to get the words, and then he would often just reuse the tape because it was expensive. Then he realized at some point, I think very early on, there was value in preserving these songs and in the voices in which they were sung, and he began to amass a collection which eventually became the Northeast Archives of Folklore and Oral History. The Library of Congress has purchased that collection and it has digitized it, is in the process of digitizing it and making it all publicly available, including recordings as well as transcripts of interviews photographs and other things. And Fogler Library Special Collections at the University of Maine maintains that as well. And there are thousands of songs in there, some of which we've published. We have a nice collection called the Maine Song and Story Sampler, which is both a book and a multi-CD set done by my predecessor, Paulina McDougall. And we have a couple other books as well about folk songs and collections. And I'm working on a couple projects right now. We are at the center on Cary Grover and other collectors with two contemporary collectors of folk songs. So we hope to continue that tradition of preserving these songs and ballads and information about their makers, in part because it does tend to inspire people, just as the early folk singers were inspired by what they were hearing on Folkways Records. There are people like the Mallet Brothers who just released their album last year, The Falling of the Pine, which was based on a book, a 1927 book called Minstrelsy of Maine, that had no music in it. In other words, there was no musical annotation. It was all just words, and they set it to their own music. So musicians today continue to be inspired by these older songs, as I think people are kind of looking for this sense of authentic music and tradition. And so that's why we feel it's important to kind of continue the work that was begun by Sandy Ives and bring it to new audiences.
And we'll hear from the Mallet Brothers a little later in the program. I do want to play a clip of a song that I think you believe Sandy might have recorded called the Aroostook War Song.
Yep, that's correct. That's on his album Folk Songs of Maine, which is a 1959 album. The only album he really made, because he turned his attention to collecting and analyzing folk music as opposed to singing it.
Yeah, so let's play that now.
Ye soldiers of Maine, your bright weapons prepare. On your frontiers are rising the clouds of grim war. Your country's invaded, invaded the soil that your fathers have purchased with lifeblood and toil, with lifeblood and toil. Then hail the British, does anyone cry? Move not the old landmarks, the settlers reply. Move not the old landmarks, the scriptures enjoin. For the sons of Columbia are west of the line, are west of the line.
You know, the funny thing about that song, the Aroostook War, is that you'd think by the tone of that, that it must have been a calamitous event with thousands of people dying. But in fact, the Aroostook War, no one died. It was a border incursion in northern Maine. And that shows that these songs didn't just exist to entertain people. Those songs at that time, those ballads, were written to inspire people to actually pick up arms in this case. And so even as in the 60s, there was a lot of anti-war protest songs and songs about the ills of war, blowing in the wind and where have all the flowers gone and so forth. There were times when these songs were written to inspire war or to serve some other social purpose. It's just one of the kind of ironies, I guess, of this kind of music.
Yeah, Felicia?
I wanted to just touch on what Craig was talking about, the singer-songwriters paying attention to what came before them and studying. And that's not unique to the United States. And I think that's something, too, that the Folk Festival brings with its global music. It's something that we pay close attention to at Portland Ovations. There's an artist coming this year called her name is Al-Sara and the Nubatones. She herself is an ethnomusicologist, and she is taking her traditional music, rooting it in culture, but fusing it with pop. And it's a new kind of folk music in a country not ours.
Let's go to the phones here and bring in Julia in Bristol. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Well, I just would like to just mention some projects that I'm working on. I've always been interested in folk music. I'm 60 years old, but I remember hearing recordings as a child, but also hearing people around me singing folk songs and being interested in where they came from all my life. And I realized that my grandfather had actually recorded my great uncle Frank down here in Bristol singing some old songs and got interested in looking at the archives. I also am a professional musician myself. I play with a group called Castle Bay, And we are looking at collections made in Maine in between 1920 and 1950, particularly those songs that were collected by Fanny Eckstorm, who produced British ballads from Maine in 1929 with a man named Phillips Barry in Harvard, and several others, also including Helen Harkness Flanders of Vermont, who collected over 5,000 songs in New England, 900 of which are from Maine, in audio format. And so I've been listening to these recordings and transcribing them and bringing them forward, not only for myself and my husband, Fred Gosby, to sing for the public, but also putting together a songbook that I hope to have produced in the next year or so, of songs that people can look at and listen and learn, possibly passing on to their kids or to their students. It's a resource that is pretty well untapped. You spoke about John Lomax. Well, we had at least five collectors here in Maine, and this resource is sitting there at the Folklife Center, and also in other places like Middlebury College in Vermont.
And some of this material is online. We actually retrieved it from there. Is it being digitized? Is more of it being digitized?
It is, and that is a wonderful thing. The only problem being that often the indexes are inadequate and incomplete. Many of these things were recorded on really old technology like wax cylinders and aluminum discs, then transferred to like cassettes, which have become compromised through time. So they're very, very difficult to listen to. It's not like listening to a recording today, which is clear and crisp. And the singers also were often elderly and would change key or misremember lyrics. It's a real labor to listen to them. So I just caution anyone that does listen to some of these that they're going to have to really spend some time with it. It's not going to be easy.
All right, Julia, thank you very much.
And I'll just say that Julia and Fred are kind of Maine treasures. Castle Bay is a very well-respected trio.
All right, Julia, thanks very much. The number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to John in Camden. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I had a comment about the Weavers. You had said that that they sort of stopped existing in the 50s. That actually wasn't true. I saw them in Princeton in 1960 with still very much with the full original group with Lee Hayes and Ronnie Gilbert. Then in 1964, a gentleman named Eric Darling did in fact become the new banjo player and fourth member because of some concerns that they had, as you rightly said. But they continued until, I think, around 1968, if I'm wrong. Lee Hayes had both of his feet amputated, and they did continue to perform until he died. And that was when I believe they actually disbanded. But Pete Seeger did clearly create some problems, and including the fact that they were in danger of losing their passports because a comment made in their live performance in 1958 at Carnegie Hall, they sang Going to Pretoria, and someone in the group wrote up, well, what's the history behind this? And I believe it was Pete Seeger who said, well, Andreas Pretorius was a famous politician in South Africa. He was a famous old Boer. And that got them in terrific trouble for that comment, which was on the Vanguard album. But they did continue for quite a time into the 60s and were an incredibly marvelous group at keeping all of the old songs alive, if you will, the old folk songs.
John, well, thank you for the history. I did want to just follow up with you. You were there. You were a part of this audience. What was the appeal? What was driving, do you think, this revival of this folk form? Was it the political activism and the messaging of the song, or was it purely musical, or both?
No, I think it was musical. I don't think the political activism got into the folk singing until the mid-60s and late-60s, and by that time, the Weavers were definitely not as popular as they had been, although they were still very political in some of the songs that they sang, but they were just such great performers and delightful to watch and listen to, and I was a teenager. And I just loved it because of the folk, as you've already announced, about the Kingston Trio, who, of course, came out of UCLA. I don't know whether you knew that. You had the Brothers Four, who were semi-folky. You had the Highwaymen, who were definitely folky. And then Peter, Paul, and Mary, who just took the thing into a whole new regime, if you will, yeah, with number one hits all over the place. And nobody expected that kind of a crossover.
Yeah. Interesting. Thank you. I appreciate it. Good history, good information. Clearly, John knows his stuff and was there. Witness that. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Marty in South Portland. Hi, Marty.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I have a question. By the way, fascinating program. And one of my favorite songs of all times is Scarborough Fair by Simon and Garfunkel. Yeah. And I was astonished to hear the history of it going back hundreds of years being the foundation for it. And what amazes me now is that with the tremendous extension of copyright durations, that some of the practices of borrowing lyrics and stanzas from old standards is now becoming forbidden. What is the hope for this kind of music in the future?
Does anybody want to field that? Feel comfortable with that question?
I'll only say to that recording technology had a marked impact on what could be done with music and copyright laws, of course. In the past, there was a time when this music was basically defined as music that had no authorship and no owners. There was even theories that it somehow sprung from a community well. And nowadays, of course, and even beginning in the early 1900s when people started attaching individual composers to songs, that began to change. And with copyright laws and so forth, it's probably be more difficult now just to take a song and perform it without paying royalty fees and so forth. So digital technology will change that further. The music will always be there. This is the thing. It won't be the same. And I think if you look at the lineup of something like the Newport Folk Festival today, how we define folk music has changed so much that it's really not anymore about singing these traditional ballads that were collected hundreds of years ago. It's about performers who perform their own original music that reflects their own culture and time and place. So I think folk music will still be around. There will be some people who will still draw upon these sources for old songs and so forth. And then there's a whole this huge amount of new music that's being generated that is also classified as folk music, but is a very different kind of music.
And we'll get to that. We're going to take a quick break, though, first. You're listening to Maine Calling, and we'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Plummer Senior Living at Ocean View at Falmouth, proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow beginning at 1 p.m. on Maine Public Classical. And Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach, working to connect businesses and nonprofits with their targeted audiences.
In Tune Friday night. This Friday, new music from Elvis Costello, Richard Thompson, Alice Merton, Eels, and so much more. I'm Sarah Willis. Join me Friday night at 8 here on Maine Public Radio.
You should hear the things that they say about me. They're saying she's no better than she needed to be. They don't know that he was kind.
New Hampshire is the only state in the country where its secure psychiatric unit is located inside of a prison.
He has a bare cell, not a book, not a TV, nothing. He just sits in there for 23 hours.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we learn more about the unit. Plus, we visit a unique summer camp.
It's just like having fun with your culture and doing science at the same time.
And we discuss the history of witchcraft and persecution in our region. Please join us.
Coming up after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And that's Bob Dylan plugged in, much to the chagrin of some members of the audience. Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the many varieties of American folk music, of folk music all over the world. Joining me today, Felicia Knight, president of Knight Canny Group, a member of the board of Portland Ovations. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Heather McCarthy. She's executive director of the American Folk Festival. And joining us also from Bangor, Craig Ettinger. He's the University of Maine's Folklife Center and Maine Studies Director. Give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. Craig, that was a pivotal moment, was it not, in modern folk history, the electrification of Bob Dylan?
Yeah, I think you could say that Dylan Goes Electric in all caps is kind of the way people remember that. But it suggests something, and I think he was ahead of his time, because there a lot of people went to the Newport Folk Festival that year, 1965, thinking they would hear more of the same. It was a combination of the traditional folk that they were hearing, the kind of the new folk, the singer-songwriter mode, but in a kind of traditional ballad form, like Baez and Dylan. And then there were gospel singers and blues and jazz and kind of beginning to branch out into those areas, even international music that we see today with the American Folk Festival. But he was also pushing the boundaries. He had the backing of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And if you hear after this song, Like a Rolling Stone, you'll hear a lot more booze. That was the second song in his set after Maggie's Farm. But he was, I think, suggesting as an artist and as a performer, he wasn't happy just playing in a way that kind of appealed to people's interests in a common mass way. But he wanted to push the boundaries of that as an artist. And today, folk music has moved into so many different areas. Folk is even a difficult label to apply to it, because it's really much broader than that. When we think of singer-songwriters, when we think of kind of folk rock like the Mallet Brothers, or when we think of more a kind of a jazzy form of folk or indie pop kind of stuff that you'll see at the Newport Jazz Festival today. So he helped to push it into new places, and today we kind of bear the fruit of that.
Yeah, Heather McCarthy, is anything at the upcoming festival next week that's kind of a good example of the modern iterations of folk music?
Certainly, I think a lot of it is. I think the group that we're bringing over from Puerto Rico, our salsa band. Salsa is an amazing dance tradition, music tradition that's been around for a very long time. But the members of Orquestra El Macabeo actually come to that group from a variety of different traditions. There are punk artists, there are ska artists, there are some rock and roll folks. These young Puerto Rican musicians have gotten together and said, we want to bring all of these musical styles that we come from and apply it to our salsa tradition, and the energy and the dance music and the lyrics, the whole package that comes together out of that, I think is a really great example of taking those older, more classic traditions and really breathing some wonderful new life into them.
And I don't want to run out of time here without giving details of the festival. What are the terms? Is there a charge for getting into the festival? How does it work?
It is free admission. There is a suggested donation, but everybody can come. We want everybody to attend this event and really see the breadth of music that is coming to the Bangor waterfront.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones now, and we're going to talk with Nate in Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Nate. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello. I told your engineer the story. In 1963, I was at the Defense Language Institute studying Korean, and before I got sent overseas, I went to the Monterey Folk Festival, and of course Joan Baez was there. I used to see her around town once in a while. She'd break into song just out in public. But this guy got up on stage who was real scruffy. He had a white guy afro and baggy corduroy pants, and I'm just a kid from Maine. I'd never seen a harmonica mount on somebody. And he sang "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall," for it seemed to last 10 minutes, and the crowd went totally silent. And when he finished, there was a long pause, like he just delivered the Gettysburg Address or something. And it took a while before people burst into applause. No one had heard poetry like that before sung. And the word went around, who is that guy? Who is that guy? And the people in my row at the festival agreed that his name was Bob Dylan. I also wanted to mention that when I got to Korea, I met another linguist who had just finished traveling the South, recording blues singers all over the South, and he maintained those recordings as well as a massive collection of American music over the years, that especially blues. And he's in a nursing home now. He sold the whole collection to the University of California, Santa Barbara. So there's a resource there at Santa Barbara that can't be equaled very many other places.
Yeah, Nate, thank you so much. I'm sorry, but we're almost out of time, and I do want to give everybody a final shot here. Craig, for people who are interested from listening to this show, can you give them a direction to go and check out what is archived?
As far as our archive material, a lot of that's not available to stream online. We do have CDs available for sale, including the main song and story sampler that I mentioned. I know the Library of Congress has been working on putting our material online, but I'm not sure about exactly the date that that's available. They do have access to things like the Anthology of American Folk Music, 1952, online, which can be purchased. And there are lots of interesting and good books out there about folk music and its history as well.
And Heather McCarthy, just I guess a final few seconds here left. Any advice for folks who want to get to the festival? What time does it start, and where do they park, et cetera?
Sure. Well, we're along the Bangor waterfront. People who are not familiar with Bangor can park at Bass Park and take the shuttle down to the site. We start Friday at 6, Saturday and Sunday at noon, and I think you should bring walking shoes and an open mind, because we've got four stages, 15 amazing arts groups, and a whole diversity of things to learn, discover, and experience.
And so how far apart are the stages? They're far enough apart that they don't overlap in terms of the sound, right, obviously?
We've got the sound very carefully engineered. It's about three quarters of a mile from end to end, from the most upriver stage to the most downriver stage.
And so they're probably going to want to bring a chair as well.
A chair is definitely recommended, yes.
Yeah, okay. Felicia, anything you wanted to?
I would urge anyone, if you've never been to the Folk Festival, make the trip. It's worth it. It's a wonderful, fabulously curated, well-done festival. It's a gift to the state of Maine. I hope people will attend, and I hope people will also check out the upcoming season at Portland Ovations at portlandovations.org.
All right, and with that, we're out of time. Appreciate all of you. Thanks so much for being here. Felicia Knight, president of Knight Canny Group and a member of the Portland board of the Portland Ovations. Heather McCarthy is the executive director of the American Folk Festival, and Craig Ettinger is the University of Maine's Folklife Center and Maine Studies Director. Sandra Harris ran the board today, and we had additional help from Jessica Duffy in our Bangor studio and from Willis Leifert. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links, at our website, mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 7 o'clock. Our theme was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.